It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The next 2 months will be critical for Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Bob Casey. He and his fellow Democrats are hoping to gain seats in Congress this November. But in the meantime, Democratic senators must grapple with the Supreme Court nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. Casey is seeking election to a third term in a state that narrowly voted for Donald Trump. His Republican rival, Congressman Lou Barletta, says Casey is an obstructionist. And Trump himself has given the low-key Casey a nickname, Sleeping Bob. Casey spoke with 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter at his campaign office about all those challenges this week.
If the Democrats win at least one House this November, what does Washington look like? And similarly, if they remain in the minority going forward, what does Washington look like then?
Well, I think what we have to focus on, frankly, is what Democrats, when we're at our best, have focused on, but sometimes we haven't. And that's kind of the basic core economic issues that face most American families, certainly the middle class, people trying to get to the middle class, and that's wages and jobs, and increasingly, health care. We're still fighting about repealing the Affordable Care Act. We're opposed, therefore, it. What are we going to do about the Medicaid program? They would take steps in my judgment that would decimate Medicaid and literally end Medicaid expansion. That's what their goal was. So we have to fight them on that. I think the president, if Democrats were to take over the House, for example, I think the president, just out of sheer political expediency, will want to make some deals. And he will want to, as he promised Senate Democrats in our October meeting about tax reform, he will want to say, I did more for the middle class. He's promised that over and over again. Maybe we'll give him a second chance.
That's going to be the campaign slogan. Vote Bob Casey, give Donald Trump a second chance.
For a big middle class tax cut.
The joke there, of course, is that I think the political bases in both parties look to this election and see if Democrats were to take a House, it would open up the floodgates for a whole series of investigations into the president, investigations that haven't happened under the Republican majorities there.
Sure, there might be some investigative work, and that's happened under both parties for decades. There's nothing unusual about that. But what's lost in this, one side will say, oh, they're just going to be investigating Republicans. Other people may call it oversight.
Let's talk just a bit about this campaign coming up, the Republican attacks on you. I think the argument is going to be Bob Casey, once he was a moderate guy back in the salad days of 2006, but since then he's become this raving obstructionist who's against Donald Trump on every front. If I'm a Western Pennsylvania Democrat, there are people out there, right, who voted for Trump last in 2016 and voted for you before, they're going to be hearing this message. What do you want those folks to know about you?
Well, the test for any president is when they take an action, is it good for Pennsylvania or not? And I didn't change. What changed here is you had an administration that came in and promised, I will not touch, he said, Medicare, will not touch Medicaid, will not touch Social Security. But he's allowed his budget director, Mr. Mulvaney, and he's allowed members of Congress to push forward on policy that would decimate these programs. And when it comes to health care cuts like the administration and right-wingers in Congress want, I'm going to be even tempered, always angry. Now, when the president is more aggressive on China, I'll support him. And I think for too long, China's cheated on a whole range of things, and we lose jobs when he does it. If the president comes out with a real American infrastructure bill, not a corporate giveaway bill, but a real American bill, he hasn't done that yet, but I'm hoping he will, to repair roads and bridges and bring broadband to rural areas, I'll support him. But what's changed here is the attack on basic fundamental programs that the middle class relies upon, and that vulnerable Americans need to get through their day.
I want to ask you about Brett Kavanaugh too, of course. But it's kind of a sleeper issue that you kind of alluded to earlier, the whole debate about pre-existing conditions here. The administration has started offering these kind of short-term insurance plans, which don't really provide the same kinds of rigorous protections for pre-existing conditions that insurance policies were previously required to offer. And at the same time, we've got Republican attorneys general from, I think, 20 states filing suit, saying that those very protections are unconstitutional. But I know there's a Republican effort in the Senate to pass a law offering some kind of assurance on this pre-existing condition here. Are you a supporter of that bill? And what generally do you think the role of Congress is here at this point?
What I'm greatly suspicious of is Republicans will try to pass a kind of a window dressing bill. The best way for a Republican, including my opponent in the campaign, for the best way for any Republican in the House or the Senate to prove they are going to stand up to maintain the protections for pre-existing conditions is to pick up the telephone or write a short letter and send a letter to the Justice Department saying, withdraw your argument in court that is challenging the constitutionality of the protections for pre-existing conditions. That's all they have to do. They don't have to pass a bill. They don't have to do a press conference. Just tell the Department of Justice, withdraw your argument. And the second letter or phone call could be to the National Attorney or National Republican Attorneys General, whatever the hell that acronym is, and say, dear Attorneys General, please cease and desist on your argument that pre-existing condition protection should be challenged or undermined or in some way compromised. That's all they have to do. Take that issue off the table and say, the American government, Republican and Democrat, are going to say for sure, we have pre-existing conditions, protections in place, and damn it, we're going to keep it in place.
So I'm going to do the political reporter thing and say, Senator, are you challenging Lou Barletta to send such a letter if he's serious about
it? I'll write it for him. Jeff Sessions, as the Attorney General, is probably more likely to take a phone call from my opponent or any Republican. He might put me on hold for a while. While I'm on hold, maybe my opponent will get through. But it's look, we finally reached the point that we put in those protections so that finally the insurance company doesn't have control over your child's health care or your health care because you or your child have a pre-existing condition. That should be off the table. That should be settled bedrock law going forward. And yet Republicans are willing to pretend they're what they want to maintain it and do nothing about it, or they're actually hostile to it because they think under some constitutional theory they want to rip away those protections.
Which leads us very naturally into this discussion of the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. A lot of Democrats, the big concern is his position on sort of executive authority and the ability to investigate the president, to sue a president, to hold a president to account.
If it's not the top, it is, I don't know what's ahead of it. I mean, obviously there are a range of issues that people are concerned about, but it does seem to shed some light on maybe why, in the end, he got the nod over someone else.
A lot of Democrats are concerned that he would be the fifth vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. You obviously are a pro-life Democrat. How will you kind of feel about a decision like that, should it indeed come to pass?
Well, we'll see what cases are brought. We don't know. I mean, there are a lot of hypotheticals here about how you get to a particular case that is brought before the court. I do know, though, that on the issue of abortion, I think in some ways it's in the interest of both sides of that debate sometimes to continue the fight instead of saying, what do we do as legislators, even as citizens, to reduce the number of abortions? One of the best ways to reduce the number of abortions, which both sides claim to want to do, is to make sure that folks have access to family planning and not have the access that women have now be reduced.
I just want to see if I can pin you down here. If Brett Kavanaugh becomes part of a majority that says, we're overturning Roe versus Wade, we're kicking this back to the states, that would be a decision that you'd be okay with.
Well, you have to see the case. But I've been clear for years, I didn't agree with Roe. The scope of that case was far too sweeping. And the next case that comes along that deals squarely with the issue of abortion may be as far-reaching as that, or it might be more limited.
The one issue where I'm expecting you're going to hear a lot of, because we already have started to, is immigration, right? So Republicans have been talking about sanctuary cities quite a bit. Typical statement from their party objecting the fact that you voted against the 2016 effort by Senator Toomey, your fellow Pennsylvania senator, to withhold various kinds of federal funding for cities that were sanctuary cities, Philadelphia being the premier example. This is the Republican Party. Bob Casey's priority is not cracking down on these rogue municipalities and respecting the rule of law but rather solidifying his liberal-progressive image with the socialist obstructionist left and filling his campaign coffers. What do you want people to know about your position on that issue? Because they're going to be hearing a lot about it, I suspect.
Yeah, look, on immigration, if you're serious, you want to solve the problem. The Republican position now on immigration is pretty simple. It's deport 11 million people. They don't have a plan. They don't have a strategy to solve the problem. They want to deport 11 million people. That's the Republican position on immigration, which is both inhumane and impractical. What I want to do and what I have voted for is legislation that will, first and foremost, secure the border. That bill in 2013 that I voted for, 68 members of the United States Senate voted for, would secure the border better than any proposal that any Republican, including the president, has come up with. More money for border security than anything we've ever seen. By one estimate, more than $40 billion. In addition to doing all that, it would allow people to be part of a guest worker program that would have rules and structure so that we could have the kind of workforce that folks in the ag community need on farms across the country and other settings. It would also have a path to citizenship, which would be rigorous, but would be a path to citizenship. You'd have to learn English. You would have to have a job. You'd have to meet certain requirements, pass a background check, and the like. So that was a serious attempt by serious legislators. Now, I know we've got a lot of politicians who are running now who claim that they're going to be really tough on the border, but they're not willing to solve the problem. They want to politicize the issue of immigration to score points in an election instead of trying to solve the problem. I don't think anyone wants a policy in place that leads to having a sanctuary city. That we would not be talking about having to deal with this issue if we have the immigration issue solved.
What's it like when Donald Trump comes up with a nickname for you? Were you like, ouch? Or were you like, man, that could have been a lot worse?
Well, it's interesting. The president had a nickname for me a couple of weeks ago. Then I saw him at a Medal of Honor ceremony at the White House. I was privileged to go. And when I shook his hand, he said, "I hear you're doing really well." So I don't know what that means.
Were you actually, I'd heard a joke that when he called you Sleeping Bob, you were actually asleep. Was that true, or was that just a joke?
It's actually not true. I was having dinner with my daughter in Philadelphia, and I heard about it later. Whenever the president wants to pay attention to me, I think he's wasting his time because we should be working on issues like health care.
Thank you so much, Mr. Casey. Appreciate it.
Chris, good to see you. Thanks so much.
Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Casey from Pennsylvania, speaking with Chris Potter, WESA's government and politics editor. Casey will be taking part in two debates between now and November. The election is November 6th. WESA and The Confluence have extended an invitation to Congressman Barletta as well. Congressman, you're welcome anytime. Coming up, a conversation about bullying in the performing arts. A new documentary, Danseur, will be shown at Point Park University tomorrow. We'll speak with the filmmaker. And we'll have part three of our series on abortion, how protesters in Pittsburgh became a national model for opposition. Stay with us as The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Reproductive health clinics that provide abortions began popping up in Pittsburgh after the Supreme Court guaranteed the right to an abortion in 1973. The clinics attracted patients, but also anti-abortion protests. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins reports that the protest groups became a model for other demonstrators across the country.
Some call them reproductive health clinics, but protesters like Kathy Laszlo call them abortuaries. She's standing outside the Planned Parenthood in downtown Pittsburgh on a rainy Friday morning this summer.
I found a song by Seals and Croft called Unborn Child. It was released a year after Roe versus Wade.
She's 56 and lives in the North Hills. She volunteers for Sidewalk Advocates for Life, an anti-abortion rights group. She played this song for another volunteer during their shift.
I thought, wow, this is kind of like what we do. You know, we're trying to say, stop, you know, think it over, you know. There's help around, you know.
Laszlo has been volunteering outside of clinics for the last 4 years. Her job is to talk to women who are on their way to Planned Parenthood and tell them that there are other places they can go.
Hi, could I offer you some free health here? We have free services, miss? Birth control? Yeah. Oh, okay. I have something for you too.
Okay.
If you've never read it.
I talked to her for a while.
Yeah, a little bit. But my goal wasn't achieved because she went in.
Her success rate for changing women's minds is really low, so her faith in God is what keeps her going. It's also what motivated her to get involved with anti-abortion rights activism in the first place. These days, the anti-abortion rights movement relies heavily on people like Laszlo, and an evangelical pastor from Pittsburgh is one of the reasons why. Pastor Keith Tusey started a small church called Word and Worship in North Braddock in 1982.
Our group was like six people. That's what we had.
His sermons focused a lot on what the Bible said about abortion. Soon, his words turned into action, and he led protests with members of his congregation outside clinics.
We were out on the streets in Pittsburgh. We just didn't have media coverage.
That would change soon. In May of 1987, he crossed paths with an activist named Randall Terry. Terry was the leader of an anti-abortion group called Operation Rescue. The group got attention for clinic protests in other states.
He said, you've got to do something to send a message. And as a result, in the city of Pittsburgh, we had one of the largest rescue movements across the country. You know, it broke loose. It just became a phenomenon.
Tusey started an Operation Rescue chapter in Pittsburgh, and over the next few years, Operation Rescue and Tusey's church held rallies with protesters numbering in the thousands.
I think what made it so successful is we reframed the question. We made it about Jesus and the Bible and his intentions for mankind.
Tusey says the tactics that Operation Rescue used were always peaceful, but newspaper archives from the Pittsburgh Press and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette detail stories of anti-abortion rights protesters coating the floors of a downtown clinic in tar and blocking the doors to a clinic with a car.
It was so overwhelming to everybody.
This is Claire Keyes. She was the director of the Allegheny Reproductive Health Center for decades. Operation Rescue protested outside her clinic. She says they blocked the doors and made it impossible for anyone to get in or out of the building. Other tenants couldn't get to their offices. Doctors couldn't get into the clinic. Patients would wait at a nearby McDonald's until city services cleared the protesters.
And we would tell them, you will be seen. Some of them would say, well, I'll just go home and come back. And well, it could be just like this the next time you come. And we promise you that once they're cleared, we will see every single patient.
Sometimes police arrested more than 100 protesters in a day. Protesters would refuse to give their names or move, and police had to carry them away from clinic doors. Tusey estimates he's been arrested over 15 times in Pittsburgh.
There was a soft underbelly there we knew we could exploit, and we did, and that's what got us sued, because we were hurting their business, and that was a wonderful thing to us.
Keyes says the disruption eventually forced them to relocate.
That landlord said, I'm pro-choice, but goodbye.
Other anti-abortion groups around the country noticed Pittsburgh and adopted similar tactics. Tusey himself went from being the leader of a six-member congregation to his current state of traveling to churches across the country and around the world. Tusey believes that part of the reason for that is videos that were filmed in Pittsburgh were watched throughout the country. They were made so other groups could learn effective protest tactics from Tusey's group. Keyes acknowledges that the strategies used in Pittsburgh spread elsewhere. And she says those cities also look to the city of Pittsburgh for advice about how to handle those protests.
And then those cities looked back to Pittsburgh like, okay, we want to learn from you. How did you deal with them? Who did you have to get into the process?
While all of this happened in Pittsburgh, lawmakers in Harrisburg were busy too. They created some of the most extreme abortion legislation in the country. Here's Sue Fritchie at the Women's Law Project.
The 1988 and 1989 Abortion Control Acts were a set of regulations that were designed specifically to get to the Supreme Court so that Pennsylvania would be the state that resulted in the overruling of Roe.
That didn't happen, but in just a few years, Pennsylvania would become a model for anti-abortion activists again. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
Tomorrow, in the final part of this series, the landmark Supreme Court case from Pennsylvania, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, how it changed abortion access across the country. This is The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin.
What people want to see when they see a dancer is not just pure entertainment, but soul and personality and heart, a sort of wildness in a way.
Even though you're going to always have questions, I think you can investigate and explore through dance.
I never predicted how much hard work it is.
It takes extreme amounts of training, physical conditioning. You'll see ballet dancers in the gym almost as often as you will at the studio.
The amount of training I was doing compared to someone who's just playing soccer an hour a day and I'm rehearsing for 4 to 5 hours.
The sacrifices I've made have been for dance, and there's been some sacrifice.
Those clips aren't talking about 30, 20, or even 10 years ago. According to one filmmaker, they're today in schools, in studios across the country. Scott Gormley is the producer and director of the new film Danseur, showing at Point Park tomorrow. He joins us on the line. Hello, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. And in studio, his son, inspiration for the film, Jackson Gormley, who's also a junior at Point Park. Welcome, Jackson.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And also Garfield Lemonius, chairman of the Point Park Dance Department. Thank you for joining us, Garfield.
Thank you, Kevin, for having us.
All right, gentlemen, as the film points out, dance requires incredible athleticism, strength and physical grace, passion and power. So why are boys and young men being targeted for pursuing dance? I want to get all of your, and we're going to start with you, Garfield.
I believe this has to do with, and the film demonstrates this, it has to do with society's expectations of what it means to be a man. The idea that men are not supposed to be dancers. Men are seen as strong, macho, which goes against the feminine qualities, so to speak, or what is considered feminine,
right.
Graceful, beautiful, passive, so to speak.
Jackson.
I feel that men in this generation feel like we should be playing sports and we should be trying to prove each other's masculinity. And like Garfield was saying, I feel that people view dance as more of a feminine, graceful form in life. And I feel that that's just not true at all, and that it is as equally masculine and showing strength as any other sport does.
And Scott, as you pursued, as you worked on this film, what did you learn about why boys and young men are being targeted?
I think it's, you know, much of what they just mentioned, but I think there's also a lack of appreciation for the arts in general in this country. I think that, you know, that one of the people in the film put it so perfectly, as Americans, we appreciate things that are practical, and unfortunately, you know, ballet doesn't necessarily really fit that.
Okay, Scott. Now, gentlemen, is ballet perhaps not viewed as an appropriate vocation, a career for boys and young men?
That's exactly right. It is not seen as a career for men. And that's probably the most, I would say that is the real reason why men don't go into that profession, aside from being seen as feminine.
Right. Scott, you are in an airport. You are touring this film.
Yes.
I wanted to get your thought. You know, is there what was brought up about masculinity and what is masculinity? Is it almost viewed as toxic masculinity?
You know, I think it's definitely there's something in this country where we question anything that doesn't necessarily fit the stereotype that has been passed from generation to generation of what a boy should do or even what a girl should do. And I think that is definitely something that hinders boys that choose to dance. And, you know, there's some inherent homophobia that's built into that as well. You know, like Garfield said, anything that's deemed somewhat feminine, and even if it's not feminine, if you ever watch any of these men dance, it's far from feminine, you know, is somehow lesser than, and these boys become targets because of it.
Garfield, as a dancer yourself, when you work with students, in addition to helping them develop their artistic skills, do you address that issue of bullying within the arts, people's hateful remarks, their actions?
First of all, it doesn't belong in the studio. When I'm working with students, it's about respect, respecting individuals for who they are, and about respecting the art form. So that type of mentality doesn't belong in the studio. I don't encourage it. We certainly may have conversations about it with the students, but it's about the work when they come into the studio to work. It's about the profession. It's about the craft.
But do they bring it, say, from the outside? This is what I'm experiencing from the outside. And you talk about it then?
We do talk about it then. I think one of the things that we do emphasize is that it's a safe space. So they can feel comfortable to talk about these issues and these prejudices that they face in the real world.
Jackson,
if I can just jump in for a second, I think, you know, when they get to the point that they're at an institution like Point Park, where they are choosing to dance openly, I think it's a different situation than the 12-year-old middle school boy who has to hide it from his classmates because he's so ashamed because they've made him feel somehow lesser. That I think is really when the bullying and the gender stereotyping is most prevalent. I don't think you see it quite as much. Certainly Garfield and Jack can probably speak more closely to that, but at least in my experience in making the film, you saw it really affecting mostly in middle school, early high school years.
Well, that brings me, Jackson, to when did you catch the dance bug and your experiences?
So I caught the dance bug probably when I was in the fifth grade. I was trying different sports and I was trying things out, just trying to see like what I really liked. And then I've always been good at dancing, I felt like, and my parents would always compliment me about like being able to just break out into dance at any moment at like family parties and stuff. So I really wanted to try to see if that could be something I could do. So I asked if I could start with a hip hop class, and then I went on to do tap and jazz and modern, and then do ballet. And then once I found ballet, I kind of just stuck with it, and the rest is history.
All right. Speaking of that history, when you started getting involved in dance and maybe let your friends know about, hey, I'm really into this, I really like this, did those friends become less friendly? What did that do to your personal relationships?
It was definitely an interesting transition. I was open about it, and they were pretty understanding about it, like with hip hop. And then when it started going to like ballet, they started to like be a little bit weird about it, and we kind of just grew apart. And like, I just realized that I wasn't with my true friends. I realized that this relationship that I had with them was not really real. And then it kind of made me realize that there are better friends out there for me, and mm-hmm. I was able to like meet with them and rekindle friendships and not be in a fabricated friendship that I thought was real.
Right. Scott, as Jackson's father, did you notice a change in your son, in his demeanor?
We definitely noticed that he went from, you know, this group of 20-some-odd friends to a group of two friends who both, interestingly had an interest in dance, one of which danced ballet. So it was definitely apparent to us that there was something going on. And, you know, as a parent, you always question, is it just the angst of being, a 12-year-old or 13-year-old boy, or is it something deeper? And it took a little bit of prodding, before we got to the bottom of really what he was experiencing. And, thankfully for him, it was so less severe than what some others experience. Mm-hmm. It was never physical, and it was verbal, but very passively, whereas other boys, are this physical altercations over the choice to dance. Mm-hmm.
Garfield, I'd like you to give us a comparison of attitudes. You're born in Jamaica, right?
Correct.
And you grew up in Toronto.
That's right.
Were there any differences in your experience? Was the environment different?
Certainly so. Here in North America, the environment towards dance is different from how it is in the Caribbean. In Jamaica, dancing is seen as a social activity, merely entertainment, not necessarily seen as a profession. In Toronto, it's quite different. It's more recognized as a profession, even though we still have less men in dance.
Mm-hmm. Scott, in touring the film, I understand that you'd hope to find some attitudes were a little different elsewhere, but has that been the case or not?
Well, interestingly, I thought of all places, Latin America would be the most open because in Cuba and other places, male dance is revered. But I just returned from Mexico only to find out that it's just as bad there. Unfortunately, there, homophobia is so prevalent that it affects the boys at a whole nother level. We've had such an incredible reaction to the film, and my hope is that, through the process of taking it around the world, at least we can start some conversations like this and open some people's eyes and perspective to the fact that these boys are just trying to do what they love to do, and we're all the benefactors of that. They're bringing the world dance, and without them, there's no opportunity to see ballet.
Jackson, I got to ask you, were you uneasy about being the inspiration behind this documentary?
No, I would say that when my dad approached me about it, I was very interested to see how this project would pick up steam and see like where it would come. And I'm very proud of how much it's reached other people so far throughout the world and in the country, and how people are talking about it. And I'm very excited for people to see the film.
Yeah. How have you dealt with the verbal abuse so it doesn't prevent you from pursuing a dream?
Well, for me, I didn't feel like I experienced that much bullying. I kind of just have learned to not listen to what other people's opinions are. I have a very good group of friends, and I have a very supportive family, so I just have learned to not listen to what other people say. Of course, there have been people who put stuff on social media calling me stuff that you should never call a person, but it's just something I've learned to brush off and just move on in life.
Right. Has it been heartening to you to hear other perspectives, male dancers older than yourself, still pursuing their dream regardless of any criticism?
It's truly inspiring to listen to some of these people talk about what has happened in their life, because I try to look at what my story is and then I listen to theirs and I realize that they have gone through far worse than I have, and it's truly amazing to see what they've done.
Okay, we have just 2 minutes left. I want to ask this of all of you. As people who love the performing arts, are you concerned that we are missing out on the talent of young artists who are dissuaded from pursuing dreams, pursuing careers in dance because of the abuse, the antagonism? Let's start with you, Garfield.
I believe so. At Point Park University, we have the ratio between men and women in the dance departments very sparse. We have close to about 200 women and really a third in men. Now, by some standards, that's a lot compared to other institutions. However, we see a decline in men going into the dance profession, and we are trying to attract men to say that it's a safe space, it's a wonderful profession, it's advantageous to society, because certainly culture in society is because of the arts.
All right. About 20 seconds for you, Scott. Are you concerned about we're missing out on a lot of talent?
I think so. I think, unfortunately, far too many boys are dissuaded by this stereotype. And I hope that, we can change some of that and alter the conversation.
And finally, Jackson, what's going to keep you pursuing? And are you worried that some other young men like yourself are not going to pursue?
I'm going to keep pursuing just because I truly love this art form, and I feel like it's the thing that was made for me to do. I do feel that some people are going to be discouraged to follow dance, but I hope that this film can go to them and they can see it and understand and try to follow their dreams and not listen to what other people have to say.
There will be a screening of Danseur at Point Park University tomorrow, Friday, with screenings in London and Washington, D.C. this weekend. Scott Gormley is the producer and director of Danseur, then the father of a dancer, Jackson Gormley, and Garfield Lemonius is the chair of Point Park University's Department of Dance. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you so much.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, a conversation with the man who deals with the tragic, deadly results of the opioid crisis on a regular basis, Allegheny County Medical Examiner Carl Williams. Plus, state prisons have been locked down for a week with major restrictions on inmates. Are inmates' rights being violated? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.